This morning, it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Kenneth Poon, who used to be up here with FAU, who now is at the Memorial Health Systems. Dr. Poon went to undergrad at Washington University and then went to medical school at the University of Arkansas. He did a combined internal medicine and pediatric residency at Jackson Memorial University of Miami. He subsequently did a tropical medicine fellowship at the University Peruna, and then an infectious disease fellowship at Baylor College of Medicine. He is currently an infectious disease consultant and in charge of the antibiotic stewardship program at Memorial, and has been very involved in the teaching of HIV, which, as you know, has become much more in the spotlight lately with a lot more treatments and a lot more prophylaxis that we should all be doing with our general medical practices. So it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Poon.
All right. Good morning, everybody. I just want to thank you for inviting me to speak. It's a privilege and an honor to give this talk to you guys. Just one other thing, one of the roles that we have here at where I work at Memorials, we have a pretty large outpatient HIV Ryan White grant funded practice as well. So we see large volume HIV positive patients that are insured and uninsured or grant funded by Ryan White. So I just want to lead with I have no financial disclosures and no one's funding me to give this talk either. Okay, so the overview of this presentation, what we're going to do is try to go over update on the epidemiology of HIV and AIDS in the U.S. As of the most recent CDC statistics, racial, ethnic, health disparities in HIV, AIDS epidemic. We're going to review the epidemiology of HIV AIDS here in Florida. And we're going to briefly go over what the DHHS, the guidelines writers for HIV treatment, what they most recently recommend. And then we're going to touch on specific topics. There's a lot to go over, so I just chose four of them that are more in the news nowadays is a switch to dual treatment and a novel agent called carbotegravir, which is an injectable. Recent agents that are novel in treatment or a class of its own, which is an antibody ebolizumab. Novel therapy with genetics, with the CRISPR sequence. And then what does UD equals UT? What does that mean? Okay, so there's abbreviations I'm going to be using, and hopefully you guys will get access to this talk so that during the talk, if there's any questions of which abbreviation I use, you can always refer back to it. I do want to pay special attention to, I'm going to use this, the pointer. Can you see the red, or is that not visible? Okay. So HIV medications usually have three names. I try to stick with one format, which is give me the generic and abbreviation, but some combined ones. I have to use a trade name. Otherwise, you get a name that goes all the way across the screen. And so I try to write those. You'll see that the trade names will be in parentheses. Or I'm sorry, italics. Okay. So at this time, what's the current status of the HIV-AIDS epidemic in the U.S.? And how has it changed over time? First, I want to say that all the data in the slide set came from the HIV CDC website, the HIV statistics website that's freely available to the public, and it's updated every year, and it lags by 1.5-2 years. So the most recent data that's been analyzed is 2017, culminating with all the 2016 data, and then they process what new diagnosis they got in 2017. So in 2016, at the end of 2016, 1,008,000 people were living with HIV diagnosed infection. So these are people living with HIV in the United States. It's a hard number. 2017, 38,739 people received an HIV diagnosis. So about 39,000 were newly diagnosed with HIV. The annual number of new HIV diagnoses remained stable, thank God, between 2012 to 2016. So if we look at this graphic here, this is kind of new. This is a distribution of diagnosed and receipt of care, retained in care and viral suppression. And so this balance shows you that how many people are actually that are living with HIV that are diagnosed. So this is an estimate, of course. And if you take 86% and think about it, That means 86% of people that we know have HIV/AIDS diagnosis, I'm sorry, projected with HIV/AIDS diagnosis, only 86% of them know that they have it or are diagnosed with it. So that means 15 or 14% are living with HIV/AIDS and have no idea they have it. They haven't been diagnosed, they're not in care, they're floating around, they're sexually active, transmitting to other people. 64% have received care. That means that 64% have matriculated, at least seen a doctor once for their HIV. That means 36% have been diagnosed and have never received care, not even once. 49%, and that's a really embarrassing number, but 49% of people living with HIV/AIDS have received care and retained in care. So they're seeing one of us, infectious disease physicians or other general physicians that practice HIV and are continuing to get care. And 53% are virally suppressed. That means 53% of people living with HIV/AIDS in the United States are actually on treatment and at the actual or at the goal that we want, which is viral suppression. That means up to 47% of HIV/AIDS people living with that here in the United States are not undetectable, so they can transmit or they can have continued disease and bad outcomes from the HIV/AIDS infection. Now, if we look at this graphic, these are people diagnosed with infection among persons that are adults or greater than 13 years living with diagnosed or undiagnosed HIV infection. So they could be diagnosed or not, undiagnosed, right? So we get this 86%, right? And we split it, we're starting to find that more and more recently, we have a balance between male and female. In fact, female may be overtaking male population, whereas in the past, in the early 80s and 90s, males predominated. Age distribution. So these are people diagnosed with HIV infection that are adults. And you see here, 86%, right, of those diagnosed. If we look at the age distribution, 94% are greater than 55. And that's not because they're newly diagnosed. It's because people living with HIV/AIDS are getting older. They're living and getting, you know, they're healthier, so they're able to survive and they're not dying so young. So the majority of people living with HIV/AIDS now are actually above 45 or above 50 years of age. And that just shows a demographic of people that we're actually aiming at. So it's no longer just a disease of the young. They may be newly diagnosed, more often young, but majority of people right now living with HIV/AIDS are older. Okay, so this is actually a good graphic. The estimated HIV incidence among persons greater than 13 years of age as of 2017 or between 2010 and 2016 shows it's been pretty steady. And if anything, a little bit less every year. So hopefully our incidence will continue to take that trend. It's taking a little bit long, but our trend should hopefully wane down to an acceptable number. So rates of diagnosis of HIV among adults and adolescents. So these are new diagnoses, okay? People that are diagnosed, that are newly diagnosed, this is the incidence rate. And I just wanted to show that between 2010 to 2016, so it's not that people greater than 55 are being newly diagnosed more often, they're just living longer with it. But it is something that we see that more and more younger people are the newly diagnosed patients. So they add to the pile, but the majority of the United States, and these will become older with the years, are living longer. People with HIV/AIDS have survived the 80s. Then, you know, they're still alive, but the ones that really started surviving is after the heart era, which is 1996, and they're getting into the 30s, 40s, and 50s now and older. So the newly diagnosed still remains kind of a young disease, and that's who we should be aiming our prevention at, okay? What are the risk factors that are most commonly transmitted? So amongst people that are newly diagnosed, male-to-male sexual contact, heterosexual contact, injection use, drug use and male-to-male sexual contact are usually what we break down the risk factors to. And amongst 2010 and 2016, male-to-male sexual contact was one of the highest or is the highest transmission category that they saw in the past. So 2010 to 2016, this is the highest risk factors of people living with HIV. Now that's changing. The landscape of that is changing. And so if you see right here in this graphic, with the distribution in the past of those diagnosed with HIV infection in 2016. So they were diagnosed in 2016. Male-to-male sexual contact is 71% of the males. But remember, females, now that's a smaller number of the males, they're mainly heterosexual, okay? So we're starting to see a shift and its transmissibility. So heterosexual is still very, very, you know, it's one of the more common ones. Male-to-male sexual contact still predominantly the most. Now, this is distribution by races. So this has remained pretty steady as far as those diagnosed with HIV infection, and we look at between 2010 and 2016, the black or African-American population for those being diagnosed, newly diagnosed between these years, these are the people, that minority is overrepresented. Basically, they are the ones that receive most of the diagnosis. If you take a look at what the U.S. Census shows, the African-American population percentage of the U.S. is, it's between 22 to 23% of the U.S. Census population. Now, if you look at this, if you take HIV/AIDS, if it was a fair distribution amongst all ethnicities, then it should be exactly the same distribution as the United States population, which is 22%. But it's actually 45%. Okay, so 45% is actually, you know, it's overrepresented for people, for the African American population. If you look at Hispanic Latinos, they've actually become 25 to 30% of the U.S. population on the census, and they are, you know, strongly represented, and they're overtaking the white population over the past years of those being diagnosed with HIV. But the black and African-American population are the ones that are most vulnerable or most overrepresented as far as the new diagnosis of HIV. Okay. So this is kind of a more of a chart version of it. And if you see here, let's see, death of persons. So if you have HIV/AIDS, and you have this infection, and you are, you know, what are you dying from? And it's related to HIV. This is how it distributes. If you look, black African-American population, 44%. Okay? So again, they're overrepresented in how badly they do with HIV/AIDS. So there is a health disparity with ethnicity and race with this disease. Okay? So people living with HIV diagnosis, and this is not new infections, but just people in general, all living with it, right? So if you take males, it's actually split between black, African-American, and white. But females, the black female, the African-American female, is especially vulnerable and especially overrepresented in those with HIV/AIDS. So this is a big driver. These are the people that are being transmitted and getting infections. So there should be extra caution. We need to take extra precautions at trying to protect this population. Okay. So if we look at it in regards to newly diagnosed infections, you see the same kind of distribution. And it's kind of redundant, but it just hones in on not only, so they, it's probably backwards to put it the other way. They are newly diagnosed in more often African-American population in females and as far as living with it and newly diagnosed. So this is people in total, and this is people that are newly diagnosed in 2017. It's the same kind of distribution. Any questions? It's probably confusing. So it's kind of both. The prevalence issue lies in that if we don't control the HIV epidemic, it's so available, it's obviously going to be, you know, it's going to affect all of the ethnicities, right? But it is predominantly the driver of ethnicity and health disparities that we see on race in African-American population that goes for all the other, you know, health issues, diabetes, heart attack, all that, access to care, the cultural stimulus, outreach. There's a lot of it that goes into it that are the same kind of pressures and factors that lie in all the other health disparities as well. It's the same kind of driver. So they are a very vulnerable population. Sorry, didn't mean to get your carpet wet. Okay, so again, now we're talking about AIDS classification. So we're not just talking about HIV, right? So HIV is when you get infected and you don't have an immune compromised system. The HIV has an advanced where your CD4 is less than 200 or that you have issues with your immune system because of opportunistic infections related to HIV. If we look at this as well, and this is data compiled from 1985 to 2016 by the CDC, again, The African-American population is specifically very vulnerable. And the white population has decreased at time, and Hispanic-Latino population has increased as well. And so we get this really big overrepresentation, again, with a black African-American population. And these are people, so not only are they getting infected more, but they're doing poorly. There are not as many of them doing well in living with HIV, getting treatment, and preventing AIDS-related infections and AIDS-related status. So this is, you know, how I look at things. It's much easier if I look at my map and say, okay, well, what region is really worse? The dark color is obviously, I mean, these are the worst states. So this is incidence, right? So per year, how many people are getting infected? So the incidence rate, if you notice, like the states are really dark. Wow, here we are, Florida. And it happens to be like number one or two at any given time. So the incidence rate of 5,000 per 100,000patients, incidence rate per year. And here we go with, this is another graphic amongst prevalence, right? 125,000 over, 125 or 126,000. California is a little bit higher, but if you think about the population, California is so much bigger. So, you know, the concentration is really high. And we're going to look at some Florida data here in a minute, and we'll see what counties are really guilty of that. Same thing here, rates of adult living with diagnosed AIDS. So this is HIV, and they're sick with AIDS, so they're not doing as well. Well, our state has overtaken California. Okay, California, I guess the statewide healthcare system does some good. New York City, and that's mainly New York Metropolitan is driving that, and so that's fair. New York Metropolitan and South Florida always competing for the number one spot. It's not the best statistic to compete for, but we're always competing for the number one spot of the concentration of HIV/AIDS. Okay. So just so you see, 440.7 versus 332.2 rates per 100,000 population. Okay. So the good thing is that the trends in age-adjusted rates of death, so if you look at age adjustment, so if they're older, you know, and stratified by age and what they're vulnerable to and what you expect for their mortality, the age-adjusted rates of death are actually coming down, and it's coming down pretty steadily. So you had the sharp decrease when that heart error in 1996 came out, and then you see a big drop in its high mortality that was climbing up until that point. But now it's steadily dropping, so that is good. Okay, so we're seeing right now 2 to 3 deaths per 100,000 population specifically due to HIV/AIDS. So again, trends in percentage of distribution of deaths. Now, if we look at the distribution of deaths, we're seeing that, you know, so the populations are split between 0 to 24 years of age, which is this kind of purple. This orange is 25 to 34 years of age, 35 to 44 here in the young middle age, 45 to 54, and then the middle age at 55 or for older. And so what we see is that an increase in the deaths with people living with HIV. It doesn't mean that HIV/AIDS is killing them, but this is a natural trend we expect. So the older population, as they get older, they start, you know, dying. So this is not a particularly bad slide. It just shows that what we're dealing with now and the recommendations that they used to have for HIV/AIDS, which, you know, you wait until a certain CD4 count to get diagnosed and then get treatment. Nowadays, we're saying that because HIV has such a broad role in disease states, it affects more than just your immune system, but cardiac disease, renal disease, diabetes, and everything else. That's why the 2011-2012 CDC recommendations changed for treatment of anybody diagnosed with HIV, and it's driven by that. And that those studies were really appreciated by the older population living with HIV that are well-controlled, undetectable. They were giving earlier and more frequent rates of diseases related to cardiovascular disease and kidney disease. And it's probably related to a theorem that we're not going to get into today, but this kind of broad chronic inflammation. Okay. So, again, age-adjusted rates of death due to HIV infection. So these are deaths related to HIV. Well, there's only one state worse than us, which is Louisiana, and not by much. So 3.8 people per 100,000 population die specifically due to HIV/AIDS. So if you take kind of all the little maps I gave you, the purple and the orange ones, and you consider that Florida is always number two in every one of those slides, and then, you know, depending upon what statistic we're looking at, the number one state could be California, New York, or Louisiana in this case. I think that kind of puts us more of number one position if we count all of that in general. How are we doing with treating HIV/AIDS? How are we diagnosing it and controlling it? So if you look at distribution in the percentage of deaths, percentage of deaths due to HIV in distribution in the region. So we're in the South. I know that's a big chunk of the U.S., but if you look at population-wise, it's kind of split more evenly. We're not doing so well. Okay, we're not really doing very well. So the South is the orange part. Green's the Midwest. Northeast is the blue, and the purple is the West. Midwest is so boring, I guess. It's nothing exciting there. But the South, we got a lot going on, but this shouldn't be one of those that we're known for. Okay, so if we do age-related average rates of death due to HIV infection by sex and race, this is where we start to see some divergence. So the Black African-American population, for sure, is more vulnerable, but the Black male is more vulnerable as far as a death due to HIV. Now, compared to the other ethnicities, they're both. Whether you're male or female, the African-American population is far worse. So what is the current status of the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the state of Florida, and how has it changed over time? Okay, so I'm going to whisk through these two. Tell me to slow down if it's too fast. I tend to talk real fast and go over stuff very quickly. Okay, so again, these aren't my novel slides. These are taken directly from the Florida Department of Health. They're public information, public slides made just so you can make presentations and distribute it. Okay. So this is our slide set. So again, compiled data from up to 2016, and then the incidence rate of 2017. So people living with HIV, these are anybody that's been diagnosed or living with it. So this is like your prevalence, right? So if you look at the counties, and you guys are here. So this is Palm Beach County, 8,488. The state total is 116,944, okay? Where I'm from, Broward County, 20,661, and then Miami-Dade, 27,969. So these three counties, are really heavily saturated, and the double counties from Broward South are primarily drivers of why Florida is so high in their numbers of HIV. Now, if we look at this statistic between 1978 to 2017, you kind of get this up and down rate of diagnosis here. And the general trend between 1997 to about 2005 is good. And then we had a sharp trend up for some reason. And that might have been because of our technology and diagnosing HIV getting better, right? The general trend is still back down. But then in the last several years, we've got a trend up. And I'm not aware of our technology getting that much better. We have a fourth generation HIV/AIDS, antigen antibody assay. But that's better, but not. I don't think it can explain this right here. There may be some better as far as screening processes out in the community and better, state policies for screening. Perhaps I don't know what the drive is, but that just scares me. Okay. So this is more of just a table representation of which counties are representing per 100,000 population people living with HIV. So Miami Division, they're really bad. Fort Lauderdale, it's pretty bad too, though. So our dual counties south of you guys are the ones primarily driving the states. Now, you guys rank about four. Like Palm Beach County are number four or five on all the counties. With concentration HIV, but we are by far the heaviest. Now, I just wanted to show you that if you compare it to the other, what we consider other heavily saturated areas, remember Louisiana was pretty high, and their high saturated areas are, New Orleans, 33%, Baton Rouge, 30%, Atlanta, which is very high as well, 29%, and then Orlando's here, okay, the Kissimmee one. Philadelphia is very high, it's, one of those that's well-known in the states. New York City and Metropolitan is not on there because I think the boroughs and how they're divided may not be easily processed and compared because it's divided very differently. Okay, so adults living with HIV at the end of 2017, we have 116,000 in the state, right? So who are these people? Who are the primary ones? Again, our state shares pretty much what the U.S. Census shows and the U.S. statistics for HIV. Black, African-American population still represent the highest percentage of those living with HIV. Again, we see the trend in age, and those are just people living longer with HIV. And our highest risk factor is MSM as well. And so that represents about 69% of those with males that have been diagnosed. But if you compare it to the rest of these statistics here, it's far higher than anything that even heterosexual female can generate. And here, 53% of the males, right? And then 49% of the females are Black African American. I'm sorry, are over 55. And 37% are Black African American in males, and 67% in females. And I wanted to kind of show you that here we start to see in our state, the Black African American race is still highest, but we're seeing this trend of Hispanic population becoming more and more prevalent, or the incidence rate going up higher for them. Now, what's funny is that it's primarily in the male population. So Hispanic males, and this is the yellow Hispanics here, and black and white, right? So the white is the blue, the black population is the black bar, I'm sorry, brown bar, and then the Hispanic population is the yellow bar. And we go through age, we are starting to see, we see that the Hispanic population is actually there's a higher prevalence of HIV AIDS in all the age distribution. Now, I didn't put the graph up there for those that are, females, but the females, it's just like all the other statistics where the black population is higher. So in Florida, actually, the Hispanic population in males are higher in their prevalence of HIV. And this is just in the last, you know, few years, so 2017. Okay, so how are we doing as far as the quality of our care of HIV here in Florida? So if we look at AIDS, right? So, you know, you shouldn't, people should not be going to AIDS if they're in good quality care, right? So it is coming down. And so that's the number we should be proud of. So for the people that we have diagnosed with HIV, we are decreasing the percentage that have AIDS. Now, the number of diagnosed with AIDS is still ridiculously high. It should be no one, but it is getting better over the years. Now, when we talk about HIV/AIDS, I'm going to show some slides that I showed when I gave this talk here 4 years ago, but it's still the same, it's still the same principle. When you get diagnosed with HIV, and the longer you wait before you get into care, really determines how many more years of life you have left on your life, right? And so if you look at this distribution of cumulative mortality, right, and the years from starting ART, so if you wait like 5 years from diagnosis to starting antiretroviral therapies, or 10 years or 15 years, and you look at the stratification, what your CD4 count is. So I know this is confusing, but your CD4 count is 0 to 49, which is, you know, the age 6. It's, or stage 3, it depends on whichever classification you want. So in age stage 6 or 3 with the new classification, and at 50 to 99, 100 to 199, and so forth and so on. And they really distribute exactly how this goes here. So obviously, the mortality rate is very high if you wait on getting HIV therapy with antiretroviral therapy, and you have really bad, you know, CD4 count, AIDS, and it just goes up with time, right? And that's, you know, not news for anybody. It's pretty straightforward for most people. If you think about 20% or so of those with AIDS in 5 years are not alive. Now, entry into care and no-show visits does drive something. I didn't want to do as much as this today because we got a lot of other stuff to cover, so I'm going to skip this. But this main principle is that if you miss visits, you're not going to do as well, and certain populations are more vulnerable for missing visits, okay? Right. So the main idea of these last few slides is kind of summarized here. Now, if you miss visits, and say you have number of quarters with the visit. So if you hit all, like, 4 quarters of a year and you see your doctor, right, that's a comparison, versus If you see your doctor 3 out of the 4 quarters, or 2 out of the 4 quarters of a year, or 1 out of the 4 quarters of a year for your HIV, AIDS, right, infection, there's a statistical significant difference in your survivability. Your adjusted hazard ratio for death goes up. So it's 1.4 times if you miss one appointment out of 4, it's 1.4 times mortality rate. Same thing goes up, and if you get 1 out of your 4, if you're barely seeing your doctor once a year, you're almost twice as likely to die from HIV/AIDS. So entry into care really do matter, how late you get in there, and how often you see your doctor is directly related. You can almost tell how many years come off their life depending upon the percentage of visits they come and see you or how many they miss. Okay. So obviously, baseline CD4 count, if it's below less than 200 and you're doing this, when you're missing visits, it's more than twice than if you had a good CD4 count. So on top of that, you can compound it by multiplying by 2.3 or 2.4. Okay, so this is a very, very poignant kind of slide. It's old as well, but again, it shows if you have HIV/AIDS and you have AIDS level, which is here, and if your CD4 count's greater than 200 here, but you took your medicine 75% of the time, okay, there is still a significant difference in how your mortality is. But it's not as bad as this side where you took your medicines less than 75% of the time. So you're taking your medicine like 70, 60% of the time, two-thirds of the time you're taking it. It's already a change in mortality, but it really makes a difference when you're at AIDS level. And so your probability of survival is 66% if you're taking your meds less than 75% of the time. And you have CD4 count less than 50. So entry into care and how we diagnose our epidemiological approach is really important, because the longer you delay care, the more life comes off their years of survivability. And how they enter care, if they enter late, you're starting in a kind of a bad place, they're already, by CD4 count stratification, going to have less chance of getting, if they miss visits, they're going to do worse than those at a higher CD4 count. Okay, so I wanted to shift gears. A couple of years ago when I did this, I really focused more on just the epidemiology, but there's so much going on in the world of the treatment of HIV. I wanted to shift over and give a little more on that today. So what are the current antiviral agents approved for the treatment of HIV? So what are we talking about as far as what's on the table now? Yeah, there's a lot now. There's a lot. This is just a pause. This is one of our magazines that go out to our patients and stuff. People living with HIV, it's called, I forgot what PAWS stands for, but it's a magazine, and they published a little picture of all the different kind of medicines that are available. This is not all of them either. I just wanted to show you that we have a lot of options for treatment. So being out of care and not being in treatment is really, really inappropriate nowadays. We can find something that's not going to be really hard on you. There's plenty of options for treatment. So I want to walk this through kind of what agents, classes they are, and what they do, right? And so if you look at the life cycle of HIV, right, so you have the virus here, and it attaches to a lymphocyte. And we all know the CD4 cell membrane kind of receptor, right? The CD4 attaches to HIV, and it has to have a co-receptor. And they interact a certain way to let HIV kind of fuse to the membrane, and then it kind of injects its RNA in, and then it uses and hijacks our proteins, as do all the viruses, and make their own DNA from ours. And so that DNA goes in, and it integrates into our DNA. And so it becomes part of our genetics once you get infected. And from there, the DNA dogma, which is, it expresses itself back into RNA, forms proteins, and then, of course, a virus sequences form itself into a virion, to the virion proteins, and kind of buds off. So, and once it buds, inside, the proteins have to mature and then become a normal virus, right? And so along the ways, we can attack it here at entry, co-receptor antagonists. We can attack it here when it tries to fuse. This is the main workhorse, the NRTIs and NRTIs. What they do is intercalate when the reverse transcriptase tries to make DNA from their RNA. We just insert all sorts of weird sequences in there with the NRTIs, the analogs, right? And then it tries to integrate into our DNA. We use the integrase inhibitors. And then when it gets expressed, the protease inhibitors basically keep the proteins from being, you know, processed correctly, split and spliced correctly. And so you have this life cycle where we attack it in multiple stages of its life. So what is the regimen that the HHS recommends? Since the heart error in 1996, it's supposed to be three active agents, right? Right now, that's still the first line recommended. A backbone, which is two NRTIs, and an anchor in one of the other options, right? So what are they? The main ones, I'm going to use abbreviations. I'm not going to use the names because there's so much to put on the slide. So just know that these are the different, there are mainly five NRTIs or five backbone components, and you want to make two of them. So you might say abacavir with lamivudine, right? Or you can do emtricitabine with tenofovir, or emtricitabine with tenofovir alafenamide, which is Descovy. And so you get two of these. Now, there are salvage ones that we no longer really use because they have so many side effects and they're not as, you know, not as effective. Okay, so you want two of those. And so what are the NRTIs? This is your backbone. These are the ones that keep the reverse transcriptase from making DNA very well. So they intercalate and make all sorts of mutations into that DNA as an analog, and so the life cycle stops right there with NRTIs. But if you just do monotherapy, the HIV has such a there's not good fidelity of the reverse transcriptase that they have mutations that spontaneously happen so often they can get past one step. So that's why we have anchor. So you have, again, two of these, and then you have to find a third agent, which there are many different classes. Okay, and I'm not going to go in specifically through each one. There are many different classes with many different options. And so you have the backbone here, and what you want is one other agent somewhere along the way. So this is your main workhorse right here, boom. And then you have all these different steps. You have one agent going there to try to stop it. And so far, with this triple regimen, we have been very successful at suppressing HIV and controlling the infection in a host. So the first line recommended combinations, as of the most recent update, which is, I think, August or July of 2019, Biktarvy, which is a combination of, again, two of the NRTIs plus an integrase inhibitor, Triumeq, same kind of setup, and then you can do, and these are one pill options. So many of the medicines are combined into one tablet. One tablet once a day, Biktarvy, one tablet once a day, Triumeq. Now, this is two tablets, a combination of two here, and then one agent here. So one tablet, and they're both once a day, same thing here. So, well, Isentris, they have a one-tablet formulation, but it can't come in two tablets where you take it twice a day. Either way, options are very easy. The side effects of these are very little as far as immediate, but sometimes people, recently in the past probably month, a new publication came out saying that the Biktarvy and the integrase inhibitors cause a little more weight gain than what we thought before. So if your patients ask you, what side effects should I expect? You can genuinely say some people get a little bit of diarrhea, some people might have a little headache or nausea in the first couple of days they take it. For the most part, most people take it, they have no idea they're on it. But if you're on Biktarvy, you might gain a little bit of weight. Okay. So for those of you who do practice HIV, I included some slides for my ID colleagues here. We are shifting away from Cobicistat, which is a booster. There are certain one-pill regimens that you guys might have heard of, Stribil and Genvoya, and you might notice that why are they not on that list? They were literally taken off between last year and this year. They were taken off as first line because of this compound called Cobicistat. Now, it's a booster. It doesn't have activity, but it boosts the elvitegravir portion of it in your bloodstream so it can work. And it's just not necessary anymore because the other regimens are so good that this booster causes some creatinine issues. It doesn't cause kidney issues, it just raises creatinine, so it makes it harder for us to understand what's going on with the kidneys, that, you know, there's not really any issue. We shouldn't have to deal with that. The other thing is that it does inhibit the cytochrome 384A enzyme, because it inhibits that to keep up the rest. It's a booster of the other agents. That can interact with other medicines. So since we have better options, this is just not first line anymore. And lastly, elvitegravir, which is this component here, has a lower barrier of resistance than dolutegravir and bictegravir. So for those that are using this, It's still fine to use it. And Jovoya, as of this past year, has been noted to have a lot of birth defects. Some percentage of them are birth defects. So pregnant or childbearing age women should probably come off of Jovoya. Okay. So what if you can't use your top two? Tenofovir and Abacavir are their top two workhorses, right? And I didn't want to talk specifically about, you know, replacing these, because most of you guys are probably going to refer to somebody with infectious disease experience to do this. But what I wanted to point out is that if you have resistance to this, they're saying there are many salvage regimens, but they recommend dual therapy. Now, you can go with dual therapy if you have a CD4 count that is greater than 200, so not AIDS, and your viral load is less than 100,000. You don't have to be suppressed, but you can't have off the charts HIV replicating in your bloodstream. And so their recommendations here are dual regimens, not triple regimens. And so an integrase inhibitor plus an NRTI, or integrase inhibitor plus a PI, or an NRTI plus a PI. And then it's with darunavir because it's the best, it's probably the most hardy one. So this is, okay, and the reason why is because when they looked at dolutegravir plus lamivudine, it was non-inferior to a triple regimen with dolutegravir, okay, in this select population. So I guess the other way you can put it is that if one of your patients on triple regimen is saying, hey, doc, I can't stand taking these many pills, or it's causing me side effects or whatnot, you can say, well, how about a dual regimen? And they're well-controlled and their CD4 is greater than 200. Some people shift to dual regimen after they're well-controlled so that they can kind of give them a respite on the number of pills or medicines they're exposed to. Okay, so dual therapy. It's an old concept that's been renewed. It's not a new concept. It's been around for a while. A lot of the other countries that don't have good access to HIV medications, particularly in WHO recommendations for poorer countries, have been trying to use dual regimen for a while. The right dual regimen, that's been an issue, trying to figure out which one is suppresses patients longitudinally without causing more mutations. And so there's been some studies, and this is what's in the guidelines, okay? And what I wanted to go through is what that means. So dual regimen, you can use something here, NRTI plus protease inhibitor, or an NRTI plus an INSTI, right, integrase inhibitor. That's in the DHHS recommendations. People aren't necessarily doing that. A lot of people are doing protease inhibitors and INSTIs, okay, and that seems to work. Now, when we look at why, we can look at one of the trials called on carbetegravir. I don't know if you guys are familiar with carbetegravir, but it's a new agent, hasn't been approved for use yet, but it is already on a phase 3 trial, but I wanted to present the phase 2b data. And basically, carbetegravir is an INSTI, right? And they actually, it's not a protease inhibitor, but rilpivirine is an NNRTI, not an NRTI, but an NNRTI, so not a backbone, an anchor. And what they did was they looked at to see if an injectable carbetegravir over a certain week period with rilpivirine, so you inject it versus a different kind of, and what the outcomes are, right? And so this was published in 2017. Carbetegravir is an integrase inhibitor. It's an analog of dolutegravir, which is on our list of medications. And you can give a Q-month IM long-acting nanosuppression. So you can inject it once a month. Rilpivirine, they formulated to where you can also inject it once a month. Most people don't use rilpivirine by itself or with other combinations because of the low viral load threshold you have for mutation. So in other words, it has an easy mutational threshold. But when they use it with this setting, they found that there was basically the same response across the board. So when they injected it once a month, 87% had virological response. If you injected 8 weeks, that was 94%, so that's better. And then carbetegravir with a combination by PO. So this is what you're usually doing, triple regimen. Carbetegravir by mouth with an NRTI combination that's accepted in the DHHS guidelines. You really see no difference, and in fact, there's a trend for better performance here. Okay. Now, with that being said, there was a percentage of patients that didn't respond, okay, only 4%. Within the Q8 weeks, so that, you know, 4% of the patients didn't actually get there, right? And then 2%. Now, everybody in between is that they may have responded, but then they kind of failed along the way. So like I said, there's a phase 3 trial pending, okay? So dual regimen with injection is on the horizon for us. And so there's some patients say, I don't want to take a daily pill. If they're okay with a Q2-month injection, which I think most people will be, that might be on the forefront soon. So this is an exciting one. This is a novel treatment, novel agent for HIV. It was published back in 2018. And this is I'm presenting the phase 3 study of this medication. And it is for an antibody called ibalizumab. What that is a humanized IgG4 monoclonal antibody. Okay, and it's specifically against one of the entry targets for HIV, which is a CD4. And so if we can block the entry of HIV by non-competing binding to CD4 on the surface of lymphocytes, then HIV cannot even enter our cells. So the trade name is Trogarzo, and it's a Q2-week infusion. The indications are, it is FDA-approved and on the DHHS guidelines, but it is for multi-drug class-resistant HIV failing their current regimen. What that specifically means is at least 2 classes, ideally 3 classes, that are failing, and you can't come up with an intact regimen. Trogarzo is something the insurance should be able to approve, okay? So where does it work? When the CD4 attaches here, the proteins here, the CD4 has specific kind of proteins here. I didn't put it on a diagram, but that's where ibalizumab works. So it won't attach, okay? Now, what did this study show? Well, I'm sorry, how was the study conducted? It was a single group. So it's not a randomized controlled trial. It was a single group of 40 patients, adults with multi-drug resistant HIV and multi-regimen failure. So those are failing the regimen. And their intervention was the therapy, and then combined therapy later, okay? So monotherapy with the antibody, and then combined therapy with an HIV regimen, okay? Their primary endpoint they were looking at were percentage of patients who decreased their viral load by half a log. And so if we look at how they went through the study, when they were screened in, day 0, they had a control period, which they were on their failing regimen, and they measured their HIV viral load and saw how they did. Then they gave a loading dose of ibalizumab on week 1, day 7, and then they gave monotherapy, just that one drug, and saw how they did and measured their numbers and everything. And then on the second week, they added the background, so whatever regimen that could be formed in addition to the ibalizumab, which they continued. And then they studied them until week 25. Okay, and this is what they found. So during the control period, very few people decreased their viral load, right? We know that during the control period, they're on their existing failing regimen, like 3% had some kind of response, okay? In the functional monotherapy period, where they gave the ibalizumab, decrease in viral load, 83% of them actually decreased their viral load by half a log. Now, not surprised, but decreased their viral load of half a log. And that's a distinct difference, a significant difference here. Now, if you see the mean change in a viral load from baseline, you see that it was more than one whole log, right? So it was like greater than 10, basically, or 10 times. So, and that was a significant difference. So there was a response in monotherapy, okay? So this is approved right now, but it's not for everybody. It's only for those who have a specific uncontrolled virus. There are more studies. I just wanted to show the kind of the cornerstone study for that. All right. Any questions regarding Trogarzo or ibalizumab?
Well, just in general about parenteral therapies, you showed that, you know, what percentage of people had AIDS if they, you know, we talk about quarterly visits, right?
And right.
If they missed 3 out of 4, they went off. So what percent of people who have HIV show up for all four quarterly visits? Because if you're now going to have them come in every 2 months or every month and everything, who's going to show?
Right. So, no, you're right. It depends on the region. I actually don't know the statistics across the board. I don't know if there's a study that shows, like, just in general, the U.S., it probably is. But it depends on the areas. Now, for us, like, I would say that most patients don't show up for all 4 quarters. And those studies were geared toward quarters, but those which are well-controlled with HIV and are virally suppressed and non-AIDS, the actual guidelines recommend that you can spin them up to Q6 or even 12 months, depending upon their social status and your relationship with them. So it's a hard statistic to count nowadays because of our paradigm and the shift of how we do medicine. In the past, quarterly, it was outrageous to think that less than quarterly, that frequency would maintain them. But things have changed. And those studies I show are older because of the bearing of what happens when you're in that situation, which is harder to find nowadays. And it kind of goes along with the slides I show with our mortality rates are getting lower, our AIDS rates are getting lower. So I don't know if I can produce that statistic for you nowadays, but most people don't show up for all of their visits. And it's how to be granular, how they're measured. I gave just one kind of study, but how gaps in adherence and quarterly visits are measured are really finely nuanced as well, because they can be defined as representation of them coming every 3 months, or if they miss an appointment, percentage of missed appointments, or did they have what their gap was per appointment. So it depends how you look at it. Right now, I would say most of our patients at Memorial, about 60 or 70% will come for 3 out of their 4 visits, something like that. So we're getting a good chunk, 30 or 40% are not hitting 4 out of 4, but those statistics are a little bit different because of the treatment regimens that are different now. And yes, there are studies looking at what you prefer. Would you be going for Q2 weeks, 8 weeks, 2 months, or whatever, infusions over the quarterly visits, and there's surprising a lot of people that would forego taking daily medicine to come more often for an infusion, though. Okay, so the last two subjects. CRISPR. So for those that you're not familiar with it, there's been a recent study literally just within the past couple months that it's really exciting. And it was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. It was a study done in China, and CRISPR edited stem cells in patients with HIV and acute lymphocytic leukemia. And this is one patient, and it's exciting because it's the first human usage of this genetic modifier. So CRISPR is a gene editing device. It means clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats. That's kind of jargon to me. What they used it for was to create an artificially disrupted CCR5 hematopoietic stem cell. What is CCR5? Well, CCR5 means one of two cell membrane co-receptors necessary for HIV entry into lymphocytes. And people without normal CCR5 are resistant to CCR5 tropic HIV strain. So if we think about the Berlin patient that was cured of HIV had a bone marrow transplant with CCR5 deletion cells from a natural donor, okay? So let me walk us through that. So CRISPR, what is that? CRISPR-Cas9, it's its full name, and CRISPR-Cas9 is basically a sequence of palindromic DNA strand with a protein called Cas9 that's actually, I forgot where it came from, but it's a protein, and it's a nuclease complex with a synthetic guide, which you make, a synthetically guided RNA, and this is a sequence we want to insert, right? And we put it in the desired location that's targeted by the PAM. So you got the primer sequence here, and then we know the primer of wherever we want to insert the gene, right? And I think this is what the guy did in China when he genetically engineered some children. They use a primer sequence where you want it, and then you inject this guided RNA. And what you can do is this allows it to kind of remove something, so you can give nothing, which is basically an indel. You get this deletion here, boom, and then it comes in, and you just put the two together. So you delete, the gene, the P53 sequence, right? And so you don't want them to have leaf Romani, you delete that. Or you can insert something, right? You want them to have blonde hair or something, you can insert it. So cosmetic genetics. Here, what they did was they deleted CCR5. So they put a sequence in and put the primer in, and they found where the CCR5 is and deleted it. Now, what is CCR5? Well, remember, that's one of your co-receptors here. So entry of HIV. You have CD4 and CCR5, and they have to, interact with both of these to come in. Basically, they found a way to be able to block this. Now, we have a medicine for that, and it's called Maraviroc, okay? And we know it works, and the reason why it works is because they first found that a genetic knockout, people born, mice, they're knocked out with CCR5, no major problems of deaths or anything, and in people, we use the Maraviroc element, that medication, and it blocks it, and they're fine. Unfortunately, when I was preparing the slides, I ran across an article recently that said there may be some health problems with longevity in people with CCR5 deletion. So we just haven't gotten there because we just discovered what that means in the last 20 years, and we don't know what it means if they survive without CCR5 for 60 or 70 years. So we have to. So be on the lookout. There may be some literature and more information that CCR5 knockouts may have a decreased longevity. So Now, if you notice, CXCR4 is another channel that HIV can go through. So HIV has to use either one of two channels, CCR5 or CXCR4. Now, if they use CXCR4, you might say, why can't we just block that? Well, HIV strains can adapt to that, and it's called dual mix or experienced strain. Unfortunately, when we knock out mice with that, they don't survive. They die in embryo or they're born with a lot of defects, so that's not an option. Okay, so when we injected the CCR5 deletion or deleted, so if you are able to inject cells that have CCR5 deleted, those cells are resistant to HIV. And that's what Timothy Brown, the Berlin patient, got. He got, he had leukemia, needed a bone marrow transplant. They said, hey, why don't we just HLA match you? Why don't we go ahead and match you with a CCR5 deleted donor? And that's what they did. And he is still undetectable to this day, and he's a really big proponent on educating with HIV. He's, he's out and about, and he's really well known. Approximately 1% of humans naturally have a CCR5 deletion, so it's pretty rare, and there is a concentration of them in like northern Europe. Now, the CRISPR-Cas9 edited CCR5 deletion, they used that and they performed it on mice models of HIV, showing some response, and that was about 4 years ago. Unfortunately, those mice initially had a response, but then their CCR5 cells became less and less, and HIV got past it. But until this trial, it hadn't been done on humans. And so they took a 27-year-old gentleman living with HIV/AIDS and had acute lymphoblastic anemia. By the time he entered the trial, he had a good status of CD4 528, way above the AIDS level, and was undetectable. He was on ARTs, that was an accepted regimen at the time, and he was CCR5 tropic. His HIV preferred CCR5, so it depended on that channel to come in and not CXCR4. So he receives chemotherapy with hematopoietic stem cell a transplant with edited CCR5 cells, and he stays on antiretroviral therapy. Okay, so they edited the cells and they gave it to him, and he stays on antiretroviral therapy. Okay, so what he does is receives 6 cycles of standard chemo, receives a mix of the CRISPR CCR5 deleted cells of CD34, which is the main progenitor that's given during the transfusions of stem cell transplants, and then also wild type, because I don't want to get into it, but the efficiency of CRISPR it's much better than the other ones, like the other palindromic sequences being used, but they couldn't guarantee that all the cells would be edited and be viable, so they had to inject some wild type to make sure the patient survived the bone marrow transplant treatment. So by the time they got through, and after the chemotherapy, CD4 obviously was lower because of the chemo and everything at 201. Viral load still undetectable at time of transplant, okay? He got myeloablative conditioning with what you normally do, and he had GVHD prophylaxis, which was normal agents that we use. And then he had antiretroviral medications. His ARVs, his therapy, held on day 220. Okay, and they watched him until day 250 to see if we hold medications now that he has the CCR5 deletions, what's going to happen to his HIV. So they held a breath and they showed that full donor chimerism occurs on day 28. So on day 28, the bone marrow took and grafted full chimerism, right? So the CCR5 cells that they noticed in the bone marrow at that time were only 5.2% to 8.3%. So CCR5 ablated cells. So these are not just CD34 cells, but all cells, right? Other lymphocytes. In the CD4 lymphocytes, the CCR5, so the CD4 specifically, the ones you want to protect, that peaked at 4.4%. So if you look at the graph here, since days of transplantation, they looked at the viral load and the CCR5 modifications. And so you can see that with time, day 200 after transplantation, the amount of CCR5 deleted CD4 cells went up to about 4.4%. And then it dropped off once they interrupted the therapy, and that's probably because of the virus, killed a lot of lymphocytes and all that. But those hopefully survived and then just waned with time and replication. And then here, the antiviral therapy was interrupted. It did go up, and that's what we expect. The viral load to go up when we interrupt the medication. So what does that mean? Well, it means that they did it to make sure it was safe to do that. Is it viable? it's viable. Now, the efficiency and how effective it is, you know, like getting it more than 5%, that's still in the works. This is only on one patient, but it shows that it is possible to do that in human. And they are able to survive the process, and it doesn't need a wild-type donor. I'm sorry, a natural donor. Okay. So last thing is undetectable is untransmittable. And this is a paradigm that was kind of gleaned over sometime last year by Dr. Fossey at one of the CROI meetings. And I just wanted to just briefly show you four studies basically that indicate that if you start HIV treatment as prevention, up to this day, there have been no people that have been undetectable and have transmitted HIV. So HPTN study, about 2,000 serodiscordant patients, none of them transmitted the HIV from one partner to the other. I mean, there were people that got it, but it wasn't the one from the partner that was positive, okay? So the negative partner. Partner 1 study, that's a 7-year. Oh, HPTN was a 10-year study. A 7-year study of gay and heterosexual serodiscordant couples. So one was positive and undetectable with HIV. The other one may have been on PrEP, may not have been on PrEP, and they were HIV negative. No phylogenetically linked HIV transmission again. Same thing, partner 2 study, same amount of years, and this is just looking at the gay serodiscordant couples. If you have the undetectable partner that had HIV with the HIV negative partner that may have been on PrEP or not, again, not a single transmission. And lastly, the opposite attract study, this is older, 2012 to 2016, 972 gay serodiscordant couples, same thing, HIV that was undetectable. A lot of them were on PrEP for this one, but again, no linked HIV transmissions. So right now, as far as the societies of AA HIV and IDSA, we're on a campaign saying that undetectable means untransmittable. And it's not to say like, oh, if you're undetectable, you can just be responsible. It just means that we need to broaden and strengthen our treatment as prevention protocol so that we get everybody in care. And if we can treat them, we actually have a chance to eradicate HIV. Okay, that was a lot of information. I'm not going to read over the summary slide because I think I'm a couple minutes over. But the slides hopefully will be available. I wanted to open up to any questions, as long as they're easy. Okay. Well, thank you for your attention. I appreciate it.